$2.99. And we're going to have Mike Burton come up. We're not going to have Kim go through the lengthy detail on this, and we've worked this enough that I think we're all familiar with it. So welcome, yeah, Mr. Burton.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Mike Burton. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and I'm a beaver. I hope that doesn't offend some of you wearing green shirts. Well, but I thought I needed to go on the record. Maybe I should have waited until after a vote. We've been through this at length. There are some amendments before us, the Dash 3 amendments, and I thought I'd touch on a list of the policy issues here, and as I go through the list, I'll touch on what those amendments, how those relate to the Dash 3 amendments.
All right, thank you.
I'm going to be working from both the Dash 3 amendments and the bill itself, 2299, because I don't think the Dash 3 amendments are a complete reproduction of the bill. The first major, my thought was to touch on the major policy issues and not the minor ones. I'd be happy to stop at any point and answer questions or go back over points that may have gotten foggy in the rush of events around here. But the intent of the bill, I'll remind you, just out of the box, is from the department's perspective was to reorder the statute. So most of the changes embodied in the bill are just moving things around and really have no policy implications at all. The other major intent of the department was to extend the sunset for the long-term rural enterprise zone exemption. Those are the two big issues from the department's perspective. So there's a lot of stuff in this large bill that's just shuffling things around. But I will touch on the major points. The first one is a proposal in the strategic investment program to create a rural component of the strategic investment program. The strategic investment program provides a tax break for projects that have an assessed valuation of over $100 million. That reality is that just doesn't happen much in rural Oregon. So the proposal in the bill is to create a category for rural Oregon where the ceiling would be $25 million. The first $25 million would be taxed at the normal tax rate, normal circumstances. Above that, there would be the exemption would start to come into play. So only after a project got to be larger than $25 million would the strategic investment program start to work. There is within that a point that was an item of contention when we originally introduced the bill. There was within the strategic investment program a component that would have allowed special districts to opt out of the exemption. We've spent time, Ms. Squires from the Special Districts Association told you last time that when we came back, hopefully we'd have a happy face amendment. I believe we're there. let me explain to you how that amendment works. It's on page 3 in the Dash 3 amendments. And essentially what we've proposed is that once the $25 million threshold is met and a firm starts to enter into the exemption, they start paying into what is called a community services fee. The community services fee has historically been allocated at the prerogative of the county in which the investment is made. Our proposal is that 75% of the taxing entities would agree to an allocation of that community service fee. If they didn't reach that point, therefore there will be an exemption, there will be a community service fee. What happens to the community service fee is not an issue in terms of the company's decision to move ahead to make the investment. What happens to the community service fee can take place offline in a separate discussion. The amendments, the Dash 3 amendments propose that if within 90 days the taxing entities, 75% of the taxing entities, come to agreement on how the community service fee will be allocated, everything's over and done with, and the project moves forward, the exemption will move forward. If they can't come to an agreement within 90 days, the allocation of the fee would fall to the Economic and Community Development Commission. We feel that will provide an incentive to them to come to an agreement. It's a circumstance that we've negotiated with the cities, counties, ports, and special districts, and I believe they'll be happy to come forward if you'd like and testify that they believe this is a good solution to the issue. Any questions on that particular point?
It says in the... It says 75% of property tax authority in the code area. So what does that mean exactly? It isn't if there are five agencies, is that... Is it the amount of the property that... So if you have one big player in here, they could swing the whole thing?
Chair Gallego goes for Representative Berger.
And do you understand it?
I believe I understand the question. I believe the answer is yes.
Okay.
It's based on there isn't one taxpayer, one collecting body that collects 75% of the taxes in any district, I believe.
I don't believe there is.
I'm not aware of one.
Okay.
And that's because of the split between general government property taxes and school property taxes. Since roughly a third of the property tax goes to schools, there wouldn't be a big dog that would make all of the decisions. So there would always be a discussion.
Okay.
It is based on the taxing authority or collections rate. I'm not sure how to couch that.
Okay. I just wanted to know what 75% meant. Thank you. I think I understand.
Any more questions on that point before everyone moves on? Go ahead.
Chair Gallegos, members of the committee. While it's a minor point, there is within the strategic investment program, this section, a piece that's new to these amendments, and that is that the maximums for the community, there are maximums for the community service fee of $2 million in the standard strategic investment program. Again, $100 million threshold. We're moving that in the rural area. We're proposing to move that to $25 million. We're also proposing a proportionate reduction in the ceilings of tax before the cap on the community service fee and other taxes. So a commensurate scaling of the program. Okay. Another major piece by design is the strategic investment, and I actually mentioned this last time around, the strategic investment program is a negotiated process. It's not automatic. So electrical facilities, which have been in the last couple of years controversial in terms of incentives, are proposed by the department to be included in the strategic investment program, the very large ones, so that they might be part of this negotiated process. Okay, I just wanted to remind people of that. Moving along, in terms of basic attributes of enterprise zones, there is a piece that is related to e-commerce zones. E-commerce zones were created in the last legislative session, and four of them were created. The department held a competitive process to determine which four of the existing enterprise zones would become e-commerce zones, and had 13 applicants, had a competition for 13 potential zones. In the bill, we've left the number of, we proposed striking out the word four and left the number blank, proposing that you would fill in the blank. I wanted to remind you that we've not covered that base, and that there is a blank in the bill that needs to be filled in.
So
if I had to make a recommendation on that, well, we've got a number, so maybe I won't make a recommendation.
No, go ahead.
My proposal would be that, like the Enterprise Zone program, when it was created, there was sort of an incremental legislature by legislature, there was an incremental increase in the number of enterprise zones until we reached the current 47 straightforward enterprise zones that are allowed under the law. Since the last legislature chose four as a magic number, I might propose that we add four more this time. The department doesn't have strong feelings about this. There would be revenue impacts of creating additional e-commerce zones. But it was the pleasure of the last legislature that we create these things, and having started the exercise, we think it might be worth consideration to consider increasing the number, given 13 applicants for four zones. And I'll move on and let you guys decide whether or not you want to fill in that blank. There is, in the short-term enterprise, the standard enterprise zone exemption, there is a major policy change related to a new local waiver. In general, existing businesses must increase employment by 10% in order to receive an enterprise zone exemption on their new investment. There are a couple of exceptions to that. In the bill, there would be an additional exception which says that for firms that are investing in productivity-enhancing improvements to their plant, they would be able to avoid that 10% exemption provided they were willing to create a retraining fee and take part of the exempted taxes and use them to retrain their workers, something that we talked about again last time. Changing the page, the first item is a minor item, but it's new to the bill, so I thought I'd talk about it here. And it gets to the next piece, which is actually a major piece. There is a provision in the law, separate and distinct from the Enterprise Zone program, which allows for projects under construction to be exempted. There are some exceptions to that. There are three classes of businesses that don't receive the benefit of not paying taxes on their investments while they're under construction. And the proposal in the bill is that, or in the amendment, is that if they're in an enterprise zone, this actually was proposed in the original bill, but it was attached to the statutes related to the tax code. The Department of Revenue has proposed that we put it in the enterprise zone program and make it an enterprise zone program and not a general tax condition. So the proposal is that for enterprise zones, those exceptions, those businesses that are accepted from the construction in progress exception, be included as enterprise zone exceptions. So all relevant firms and all qualified firms, if they're qualified for the enterprise zone exemption, they would also qualify for a construction in progress exemption. This, again, has relevance to the large electrical generating facilities, and Mr. Jim Anderson will be, I believe, coming up to speak to you a little bit later about how that affects a client of his. That's the major exemption related to centrally assessed property. And that is the one place in the statute where we have proposed for a special district opt-out. Special districts could elect to not participate in that exemption for centrally assessed property. I'm going to roll down the page to the only moderate policy item on this page. It's part of the long-term rural enterprise zone tax incentive. There is an anomaly or a unique feature currently in the long-term rural exemption where it's the only place in this set of statutes that an existing investment becomes exempted from the enterprise zone. In general, land is never exempted, and existing real property improvements are not exempted. We believe that that's a good provision, that property that's already paying taxes should continue to pay taxes. So the bill would propose to remove that that existing investment component from the long-term rural exemption. And finally, the reason for one of the two reasons for the department bringing forward the program, the department believes that there's potential for the long-term rural program to work. We believe it's a good program. Given the state of the economy and the relative newness of the program, it's not been used except for one case, which is Roseburg Forest Products. And I wanted to bring to your attention that we're proposing the bill would extend the sunset for two more years to 2006. With that, I would conclude my testimony, which has been short today, but long overall. And welcome any questions.
Any questions? Mr. Representative Pass. Mr. Pass.
Mr. Representative Luke.
Yes. All right.
Thank you. On the electronic commerce zones, I'm not sure where we stand with that, because we had talked about earlier in the session about when we passed this, we designated four places with the idea of encouraging more development in rural areas as opposed to Washington County or Eugene or something. And by expanding that, depending on what we do, we then lose the incentive to go into a rural area. We just make it more, I guess, user-friendly for somebody to continue developing this kind of enterprise in Washington County. And that's kind of, you know, as we discussed, a policy issue. Do you want to help? Do you want to give rural Oregon an advantage, or is this a statewide thing that we're doing here? So there's sort of two goals there, and I'm not sure where, with these amendments, that puts us. And I know there's a blank there, but probably need to make a decision on which one of those goals we want to address.
Chair Smith, Mr. Representative Haas, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the question, and that's why I suggest that the department doesn't have strong feelings. There is a policy balance, and we were suggesting an incremental change so that we can work our way into this question, especially given the state of the budget and the potential for probably not meaningful revenue impact, but definitely a revenue impact.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I was one of the sponsors of that bill in 2001, and the idea was to help rural Oregon achieve a little bit of an advantage and encourage development out there as opposed to Hillsborough. Not that Hillsborough doesn't need the jobs, but the idea was, you know, to encourage economic growth in rural Oregon.
Chair Smith, Representative Haas, I would point out that the law does currently contain a distinction between urban zones and rural zones, and by making it clear that it's your intent that this be attached to rural zones, you could sort of, the question still arises, how widespread do you want this to be, how generally available do you want it to be, but you can make it clear that it has to be in rural zones, by, and I'm not sure that that's not already there, but...
It just says, yeah, this just says... But we said there were four.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Representative Berger.
Could I follow up on what you just said? The language that's in this amendment speaks to rural enterprise zones specifically? That where we're considering increasing the number?
Chair Smith, Representative Berger, I'm looking through the statute.
And I was looking
I can't remember.
You could go right to
I
it.
Can't remember, but the program does overall create a distinction between urban and rural zones, and I'm suggesting that you could use that distinction to address Representative Haas's point and make sure that that any additional e-commerce zones were dedicated to the rural zones.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does answer my question, but it begs the bigger policy question. 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we were trying to encourage this in rural zones. Right now, we want this in any zone. If it's going to be helpful to economic development, I wonder if we're less married to restricting it to rural zones. That's just a policy question.
Right, that's something we need to decide.
Yeah.
Representative Richardson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Burton, I have a question relating to the amendment on page 11 where it discusses the qualifications for a motel to be considered subject to these benefits. And I'd like to have you just kind of explain how does a motel equate with, you know, bringing in business and economic development and all of that? I mean, is this essentially carving out a niche to benefit the lodging industry when it really isn't part of what was originally intended?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. Not sure exactly which came first, but at one time there were, within the general statutes addressing economic development, there were specified by law a number of key industries. One of those key industries was interstate tourism. So it was recognized that visitors coming from out of state are bringing wealth or capital to a community, and in some parts of the state, that's a big deal in terms of the base economy. The point of the existing law is that within any given enterprise zone, there is an election, a one-time election, to either allow the exemption to go to hotels, motels, and destination resorts or not. So the whole zone, it has to be homogeneous in that regard. What the bill proposes is that there would still be a one-time election, but it wouldn't have to be homogenous across the zone. And this is specific. This arose specifically in Lincoln County, but it also came up in Morrow County. But Lincoln County is not interested in incenting any more hotels or motels. Lincoln City is not interested in that. The Lincoln County zone currently allows an exemption for hotels, motels, and destination resorts. So there, you will hear a bill that proposes additional enterprise zones so that Lincoln City can get its own zone and not allow hotels, motels, destination resorts. We're proposing that the co-sponsors, the jurisdictions, cities and counties that are within a zone, be allowed to make that election based on circumstances unique to their community and live with it. It's a one-time election, but would allow for Lincoln City to make a different choice than the rest of the Lincoln County zone. So that's the point of the amendment. The law already allows for the exemption to go to hotels, motels, and destination resorts that in zones where, that have made that choice. That's not a change we're making here. We're proposing.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Would you mind help me find that? Because I'm reading it says, in order for the property to be qualified property under ORS 285B713, the property must cost, and then it lays things out. And so I just missed where it said that this is going to be up to the jurisdiction. Choice will be up to the jurisdiction to allow it or not allow it.
Yeah, I know.
Madam Chair, if I can help you find it, I think it's section 17, page 14 of the bill.
That's about right.
I think this is what you're looking for, approximately line 18. The election shall be made by a resolution adopted by the city or county governing body.
That's what.
Okay. Did you find it in your bill?
No, but I just need to follow up on, okay. Just get a clarification then.
Sure.
And the clarification is, you said it's a one-time decision. Is that decision, is it already made for all of those jurisdictions that already have these in place? And so they either said yes or no, and then new ones will have the opportunity to make it. And does the wording here make any change in those jurisdictions that have previously made that decision?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. I can't remember clearly, but I believe we did allow a period of time for them to revisit the question and again make a one-time election. But it's our intention that it not be a bouncing ball. That if someone was interested in using this exemption and might use that as part of the basis for a site location decision, that it would be decided they could just go to a map. Look at those zones that allow for this sort of use and decide whether or not to do it in that zone.
It's also on page 14, under section 17, subsection C. Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Chair Smith, if I could, I would go back to the e-commerce question.
Okay.
And again, I'm not finding the exact language, but getting to the non-urban or urban.
Right.
On page 18, section, halfway through the page, about on line 24 and 25, it says that are required of the sponsor of a non-urban enterprise zone. So we might already have, the legislature might already have made the distinction that this is about non-urban zones.
Thank you.
To make sure of that, you could so instruct.
We could, yeah. That's something the committee is going to be discussing, I'm sure. Thank you. Anything else? Any other questions for Mr. Burton?
Excuse me. I just read the note that Doris brought up here. And it says that under the current law, they can be placed in rural and urban zones. So if you wanted to limit additional e-commerce zones to rural areas, you'd have to include language to that effect.
You'd have to have the specific language. Okay. Thank you very much. All right.
Just yes.
point of clarification on that, Mike. Rural or urban, as long as they meet the criteria listed here, is that correct in Section 24, Sub 1, A through D, which doesn't make it
right.
Exactly any enterprise zone. You have to be an enterprise zone. You could be rural or urban, but you must meet these other criteria as well.
Right.
Which would kick out some of the urban zones. But, I mean, the effect of it, basically.
That's okay.
The stores weren't just not
I actually think
no.
That's a different thing. That's a different thing.
Okay.
There was within the bill one anomaly that there's actually the potential for a fifth e-commerce zone in a place that's not necessarily an enterprise zone. We refer to this as the North Plains language, but there's potential for a fifth e-commerce zone that's different than the rest of them.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So there is a distinction between rural areas and non-urban enterprise zones. So there's a distinction, I guess, between rural and non-urban. They don't mean exactly the opposite or the same.
Right. Chair Smith, Representative Haas. There is within the department's language a definition of rural areas, which are essentially communities of less than 30,000 people. So in general, when we refer to rural, we're using the definition that's in that statute. Non-urban is a particular class of enterprise zones, and I can't tell you off the top of my head whether or not those are mutually exclusive or related. But for all intents and purposes, the urban zones are Portland, Salem, Eugene, and Medford, or communities in and around them.
Does that answer your question?
Well, I mean, I think we still do need to make a distinction and make a choice. Even non-urban areas are still a little bit vague, and that's targeting any.
Chair Smith, Representative House, I can take the time to find the non-urban section if you'd like. I can do that while you're listening to someone else.
Why don't we do that? Because I think that's something the committee is going to really have to know.
All right.
We'll go on and hear the rest of the testimony. Thank you. Hacina Squires, Special District. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Hacina Squires, on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, with the Happy Smiley Amendment, which I didn't think we would get to. We did have quite a bit of discussion regarding the whole opt-out provision within the SIP program, and are pleased to come to you and say that we have some agreement regarding the -3 amendments and that we are fine with the bill with the -3s.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative March?
We also have some -2s. Do you have any comments on those while we're here?
I think she's seeing.
See, that's a good thing I asked. Now you're on alert that there's a -2 out there, too.
Madam Chair, Representative March, it's possible that I've seen the -2, but I really have been focusing on the -3. So
thanks.
I'd be happy to take a look at them and.
Well, we're going to have testimony on those.
Okay. Yeah, I just thought while we were here, we'd save time if she'd already seen it.
Sure. Any other questions? He's not waving. She's going to look at him.
No, I have not seen these.
No, I have not seen these. Well, we're going to have testimony on those.
You can come back.
Do you want to wait and come back and give you a chance to read them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Jim Anderson and Bob Hansen?
Yes.
Of course. We're just flying by the seat of our pants today, aren't we?
Sarah Smith, Representative Haas, to get back to the urban, non-urban question.
Yeah.
Under the definitions which are in the bill, on page 12, there's a definition of urban enterprise zones on line 28. Non-urban enterprise zones are the ones that don't meet that definition. They're defined above on line 3. But essentially, the urban zones are those in the metropolitan areas, which are Portland, Salem, Eugene and Medford. So our definition of rural at 30,000 isn't absolutely consistent with that. Those Albany would be a non-urban zone.
Thank you. Any questions? Do you have any other follow-up? No? Okay. Thank you so much. Now we'll go to Jimmy Henderson and Bob Hansen. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Jim Anderson, here today representing the Vista Corporation. With me is Mr. Bob Hansen. He is a corporate tax manager. The Vista is a corporation whose headquarters are in Spokane. They serve both electric and natural gas customers in the state of Washington and Oregon. Oregon primarily is, nearly exclusively, is natural gas service in southern and eastern parts of the state. I would like to begin by thanking the chair and the committee staff for all their help and assistance in the Dash 3 amendments that we see before us today. Without your help, we wouldn't be sitting here supporting House Bill 2299 and the Dash 3 amendments. As I mentioned, Avista is a natural gas utility in this state primarily. However, we do have electrical generation facilities located on the Columbia River, specifically Morrow County, and that's what brings us here today. Oregon has a unique position in the western United States. Oregon primarily imports all forms of energy products. The majority of energy products we use in this state come from out of state. Therefore, the state is subject to prices set by others. And that, when you're in a time like we're in today, with the economic development of the state in dire need of a fix, and that's what this committee's mission is, we feel that anything that we can do to support an issue that is before you today and work with you on developing the future energy of the state, we are happy to do. To that end, you are talking about, and primarily what we will speak about today, Mr. Hansen will speak to, is Section 34 of the bill. Section 34 is construction in progress section, and that is a tremendous step forward when you try to develop an energy facility, a generating facility that similar to the one that Avista has developed at Coyote Springs in Morrow County. Mr. Hansen will get into more of the detail of why that is beneficial to corporations like ours. But needless to say, the corporation is thoroughly behind the efforts of this committee and the economic future of this state. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Hansen.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Hansen. I am the tax manager at Avista Corp in Spokane, and we do currently own and operate quite a few generating plants, primarily hydro, in the Pacific Northwest. We're also in the process of jointly constructing a combined cycle combustion turbine in Morrow County. It will be approximately a $250 million plant when it's finished, and it will operate on natural gas. This will be our first electric plant of any significance in the state of Oregon. We do operate quite a bit of natural gas distribution down here. The significance of an exemption, the enterprise zone exemption, and or in combination with the work in progress exemption as it's amended in here, can't really be overstated. We anticipate ultimately that we will be paying between $5 and $6 million of property taxes related to this plant. That, other than the actual acquisition cost of natural gas, that will probably be by some margin the highest operating cost we have per year. So any kind of an exemption or delay or deferral of taxes of this nature is exceedingly important and very beneficial and taken into consideration in siting this plant. Again, we were under construction approximately 2 years right now. We're a little behind schedule. We plan on having the plant operational sometime around June of this year. So I really don't have a lot other to add than that. Again, thanks for the opportunity to let me speak and, again, emphasize how important this is to us.
Well, thank you. We're glad to have you. Any questions? Representative Richardson?
Madam Chair, if you've already been in construction for 2 years, the decision's already been made because you had been planning for years before that, and now this is about to take place, what is the benefit for Oregon to grant this kind of tax exemption for you when you're already doing what we're trying to attract with this kind of legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, the original construction period actually was anticipated to be well under 1 year. We got into this project. We invested in it partly with the assumption of the Enterprise Zone credit. Based on the initial construction period, it looked like we would phase into that Enterprise Zone, that five-year period, without having any significant property taxes during the period. What happened with the delays in construction, we faced an unanticipated approximately $2.7 million tax bill last year, which we did pay, and we basically just slipped by a short period of time this year in qualifying for the credit in 2003, which would then be looking at paying more. My understanding of the way these amendments work is that the overall 5 year benefit period or potentially 5 year benefit period that we would be eligible would not in total be impacted. That in that the work in progress exemption, we would in essence be getting in lieu of or counting towards that 5 year on the Enterprise Zone. I'm not sure I'm exactly answering your question. I guess, you know, that always is legitimate on facilities of this nature. You know, what really benefit is it by extending this when the decision's already been made? I guess the only real answer is that there's certainly this won't be the last plant built, and again, as I stated, this is a major benefit to our company and certainly figures into the economics of siting. So I think that we're obviously not going to undo this plant if something went wrong, but down the line, having this in place and being able to utilize it certainly benefits us to the future.
If I could follow up on Representative Richardson's point, this point comes up a lot in the Revenue Committee. There's a fine line in whether incentives are rewarding someone for behavior they may or may not do without those incentives. So are you saying that you would go ahead and finish this and do this with or without this new language? And are you saying that it ultimately would be a wash because of what you would pay anyway?
Excuse me. Madam Chair, Representative Haas, I'm losing my voice here all of a sudden. The plant, at this point, the plant certainly will be completed. We're only a short time away. We actually had a failure of a major component in a transformer. We'd be operational right now. And I guess, again, the answer is I don't really know how to answer. We needed a combustion turbine. The Northwest may be right now, but certainly will be energy deficient in the next few years. It really comes into a question of where you site the plants. And this is one major factor. Like I said, property taxes are a big piece of it. It may not impact our decision to build one, but it certainly impacts your decision of where to site it. And as been stated earlier, there's not a lot of generation in the state of Oregon. We believe that it probably benefits everybody in the Northwest and certainly the people or customers in Oregon to have more generation down here. And an incentive of this nature makes it a lot easier for us to do this plan and possibly, you know, more in the future. I can't speak to when or if, but it's not going to be the last plant built.
I know it would make it, an incentive would make it a lot easier for you. It makes it more difficult, though, for the schools and the people to benefit from those taxes. And I'm just wondering, are you saying that you would withhold putting other generation facilities in without this, or what?
No, we wouldn't, but we would certainly put them in the places that are the most economically feasible. And I'm not prepared to speak to all the factors, and I certainly wouldn't portray that taxes and tax incentives are the only factor by a long shot. There's certainly a lot of other very important factors, fuel supply, even population centers and transmission, and ultimately those factors are equally important. And I believe in being a responsible taxpayer, and recognize the benefits that something like this contributes. Again, the enterprise zone credit was something that we were qualified for and it was available to us, and we fully anticipated having it right now. As I understand the amendments, this does not extend any ultimate total tax incentive in total that we would not have gotten had we not been delayed anyway. So in that respect, I don't believe we're asking for any more tax incentive here than we would have gotten had we been online and under normal construction, which would have had us completed over a year ago.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah. Tom Linhers, I got it right. Linhers, he'll tell me. With a name like Smith, sometimes it gets easy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Linhares.
All right.
Sounds easy once you hear it.
Yeah.
I'm the Columbia County Assessor, and I represent the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I was asked to come today. I normally wait until the bill is in the Revenue Committee, with all due respects, but I was asked to come today just to give you the sense of where the County Assessors Association is on House Bill 2299. I'm happy to do that. Okay. From our viewpoint, there are three goals of House Bill 2299, and those three are to reorganize the statutes to make them more readable. The second goal is to simplify the programs, and the third goal is to make some policy changes. In terms of the first goal, we think House Bill 2299 is on target. The statutes have been rewritten practically every session since the program first started in the late 1980s, including massive changes in response to Ballot Measure 5 in 1990 and Ballot Measure 50 in 1997, and they are, quite frankly, almost unreadable. There are often times when I'm pretty sure I know what the law says, I go to find it, and I just simply can't find it. And I'm as familiar with the statutes as probably, most anybody. And I simply can't find where it is in the statute I know I've read before, because they're just so disorganized. So if that was all the bill was doing, it would be well worth all of the effort that has been spent on getting this bill drafted and in front of you. The second goal, to simplify. Well, quite honestly, I don't think that's possible. This program, and I'm primarily speaking of the Enterprise Zone program, is probably, if you looked at the three most convoluted, complex, impossible to explain to taxpayer programs in the property tax system, they would have to be farm use, urban renewal, and enterprise zone. They're extremely complex, and to make them simpler, I think you'd have to just throw everything out, start from scratch, and then you wouldn't have a program that was as targeted as you'd really like it to be. In some ways, this bill may make things more complicated, but it's an admirable goal to simplify things. With something this complicated, I just don't know that that's possible. The third goal is to make some policy changes. Quite honestly, the original bill had some policy changes that we flat out didn't like, but I have to compliment Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. They've been very willing to listen to our concerns, and a lot of what's in the -3 amendments are directly related to concerns that the assessors and the Department of Revenue raised about the bill, and I appreciate their willingness to do that. And so I think with the -3 amendments, we are fine with the bill, and we would urge your support, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions?
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me ask, this is not a question I asked Mr. Burton today, but I'd asked, he's been before us several times related to this bill. So since take advantage of, because I intended to ask my own county assessor this and have not run into contact with him yet. One of the things, as Mr. Burton, I think, described again today that the bill would do would be to take for the strategic investment program not just property valued above the $100 million property value cap, but for rural areas to lower that down to $25 million. I realize you are in one county, but since you're representing the assessors overall, what's your sense about basically carving out two categories, one, anywhere in the state above $100 million, or two, just in rural areas below $25 million? What's your sense about other parts of the state that may not be rural, but which may fall in between those two levels?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, that's an excellent question. The strategic investment exemption program as it exists today, there's a good reason why you only have the high-tech chip manufacturers that have qualified. If you analyze the nature of the exemption, it really takes probably in excess of $600 or $700 million in property value to really make that program work. There was a company, and I'm sure OECD could answer the question, in Eugene that was in an enterprise zone. And they looked at strategic investment versus a five-year enterprise zone, and far and away the five-year enterprise zone was better for them, even though this SIP goes for 15 years. So I think lowering the threshold for strategic investment is a good thing. There are some areas of the state, and again, to really make that work with a $25 million threshold, you're probably going to need a project of $200 or $300 million to really make a payout. Because remember, the $25 million is a starting point. From there, it goes up 3% a year for 15 years. And particularly when you get high tech, that property depreciates so quickly that with a 3% increase in the $100 million and the depreciation of the equipment, it doesn't take long for those two numbers to intersect. So personally, I think that's one of the things I think that makes that why this bill makes things more complicated is you now have a company that is going to invest, say, $200-$300 million, and if they're in an enterprise zone, they're going to have to analyze whether the enterprise zone, the strategic investment, or with the lower thresholds for the rural long-term exemption, they may qualify for all three of those, and they're going to have to do an analysis as to which three is better for them, which just complicates things. It gives them more options, but it does complicate things. Representative Hunt, did I answer your question, or did I ramble?
No, I think you answered a lot, okay. But if I could just follow up, Madam Chair.
You may.
Thank you. Just looking at your own county, do you envision projects coming along that might qualify for the SIP? Yeah, and with that 25, with the cap lowered down to $25 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, we actually have in our lower Columbia Maritime Zone, which is Clatskanie, and even in the Clatskanie County, we've actually got three projects. The one project, an ethanol production facility, if I remember right, they're at about $120 million, and they would probably be better off with the regular five-year enterprise zone. We also have two energy projects that are proposed, both in the $300 to $350 million range, and I think we're probably going to have to take a step back and do some analysis to see if the $25 million strategic investment wouldn't be better for them. So, I mean, I think they're one. Both those companies may be in that position where they'll have to look at both programs to see which one gives them the most tax break.
Thanks.
Okay.
Can I follow up on that?
You may.
I think one other consideration, depending on what company it is, the enterprise zone gives them more tax break up front, whereas a strategic investment, they pay taxes on the first $25 million. The tax break goes longer. So it could be just a question of cash flow. I mean, if it's an existing company with cash flow, they may decide to go the strategic investment, pay more taxes up front, but get it for a longer period of time, and in total, a bigger tax break. If it's a brand new company, pinching pennies, having to go to New York to get financing, they may want to have more of their tax break up front until they get on their feet and get their cash flow established. I mean, there's those kinds of considerations as well.
Great, so. Thank you. Thank you very much. Doug Riggs. I think he's going to explain our Dash 2 amendments. Okay. Welcome.
Madam Chairman, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs with PacWest Communications. Here today on behalf of Gold and Northwest Aluminum. We have plants in the Dalles and Goldendale, Washington. And we're here today in support of the underlying bill and the Dash 3 amendments and also the Dash 2s, which are my fault. So you can blame me. As my handout notes, the Economic and Community Development Department currently has the opportunity to offer enterprise zones to attract new businesses. They also, in theory, have the opportunity to offer or create zones that would benefit existing businesses. But no specific direction or category is clear and focused in the statute that would allow them to provide these kind of incentives to businesses that already exist but have been operating at greatly reduced levels. What the Dash 2 amendments would do would give the department an additional set of direction to consider making existing companies that are operating at these greatly reduced levels the same type of incentives that we'd offer to a company from out of state. Let me tell you why I think that's important. If I am a company that already has a building, facility, infrastructure, permits, and maybe employees, although those employees might be laid off, and I am looking at an opportunity to restart my company, I could probably do so much more quickly than if I were a business person from outside of the state seeking to locate in Oregon, where I would have to go through an industrial siting program, apply for permits, hire and train employees, et cetera. And so as I was looking at the underlying bill at the beginning of the session, it struck me that if there was an opportunity to give some direction to the department to help existing companies out, that we might see economic development take place even more quickly than if we were trying to do what every single other state in the country is trying to do right now, which is entice other companies to come in. Not that that's not an admirable goal. I strongly support trying to get new companies to come in, but in my conversations with friends of mine who are from Washington, California, they are pursuing equally as aggressively the siting of new companies and facilities. So not to say that that won't happen, but I think there's a tremendous opportunity here to say to, you know, in the case of my client, Golden Northwest Aluminum, they have a plant in the Dalles, Oregon, that is down approximately 85%. Those are almost 1,000 well-paying jobs in a rural community. And providing an enterprise zone incentive would not in and of itself be enough to convince them to open their doors again at 100%. But it might be one of the tools in the toolkit that would allow them to restart operations. And when you're talking about a rural community, these are high-paying, highly skilled jobs that have a tremendous impact on schools, on economic development, on other tax-based programs in the state. So struck me as I was going through this that there would be an opportunity not to create a whole new category and mandate a whole new set of programs for the department, but to give them the statute authority to have one more tool in their toolkit as they were exploring economic development. I have spoken with the department about this. I let them speak for themselves, but it doesn't seem to be a fundamental objection to my amendment as long as it doesn't hold up the bill. And, Madam Chairman, as I told you today, I have no interest in holding up the bill if there's a significant objection. But I've talked to a variety of people on this. It seemed to make some sense to people. I think it would give, again, one more tool in the toolkit that could be used. So I hope you would be able to support it and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reeves. Representative March?
Doug, does this, since we're dealing with an existing firm with an existing plant, does it exempt that firm from making any investment other than hiring?
I think that the department would have to work out a set of rules that would cover this in particular. I think the argument that I would make, Representative March, is that in many cases these companies have already made a significant investment. I will give you the example of Golden Northwest. They are planning on making a significant investment in technology to bring a brand new smelting technique to the Dalles plant. Obviously, they cannot do that without lower power prices and hopefully some economic incentives. So there would be some amount of investment. I can guarantee you it won't be $20 million in a rural community and a plant that's already operating in the red at this point in time. So I couldn't tell you exactly what that number would be, but I would expect that if a company is going to reopen and keep up to date with all the environmental technologies, that they would have to invest some amount of money. I just couldn't tell you exactly what that would be.
And it doesn't require it in this.
Not in my amendment, but then again, what you'll notice in my amendment, as you read through it, is we don't change anything in the underlying program. What I wanted to do is come up with an amendment that wouldn't make a major change in what we already, the process that we already have. And I've also made an exception, if you look on page 2, line 5, that addresses the question I think you asked of the Cena Squires earlier. We have given special districts the opportunity not to participate in this particular section.
Representative Richardson?
Chair, Mr. Riggs, just kind of a point of clarification. In the bill it says that there will be a commitment to hire or rehire at least 250 employees, and the handout says that they would rehire at least 150 employees for 24 months.
Correct, Madam Chair, Representative Richardson. When I had initially drafted it, I put 250. I had submitted a change to legislative council that had not gotten incorporated in the amendments, which I just saw this morning. So when I was typing up my talking points this morning before I came down, I put the 150, assuming that the amendment would be 150, but the amendment came back at 250. We would have no objection to 250, but we certainly think that, especially in rural communities, a lower number would still be reasonable and would probably incent more economic development in these rural areas.
One follow-up?
Yes.
In the original amendment, it says hire or rehire, and in your sheet it says rehire, which implies it would be the same people that got laid off. Is that what you meant?
Madam Chair, Mr. Richardson, I think what legislative counsel probably did is anticipate that in some of these cases they may have been closed down for such a lengthy period of time that some of these people may have gone off to other opportunities for employment, and therefore the hire is probably something that legislative counsel thought would be reasonable to add, and we certainly have no objection to that.
Any other questions? Mr. Riggs on the dash two.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Did Hasina Squires want to come back up?
Oh, she did.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Greg Baker. I'm the Executive Director of Special Districts Association. Hasina and I had time to look through the dash two amendments, and we see no issues for special districts, so we'd be happy with them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that wants to testify on House Bill 2299? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2299. And committee, I think we need to do some work on some of these, putting them together. And I think we'll do a work session on Wednesday. So if you have any questions or conversations, maybe talk to me before then. Okay. So, yes, where's my question? Here we go. All right. Going to open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 33. Close a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 33. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2890. Now close a public hearing on House Bill 2890. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3071. Close a public hearing on House Bill 3071. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2296. I'll close a public hearing on House Bill 2296. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2302. And I'll close a public hearing on House Bill 2302. Seeing no other business before the committee, we're adjourned.
Good tapping.